Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Abington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the War Report. And for those of you who are listening for the first time, we welcome you as well. Well, today we're going to get off into an area that, up until recently, drew very little attention in the nation and in states and cities. Locale, but now with some events that have taken place, what I'm about to mention has in some cases become national headline events. And what I'm talking about is the fact that we are here in the beginning of August, and in some locale, public schools are about to commence. Come this fall, there's going to be an election, 2014 election. And in some locales, there are going to be school board elections, as well as election for statewide and federal positions. And I thought this was a good time to dive into a subject that, as I said earlier, really gets a little, very little attention until recently, and that is school board elections. Here in Los Angeles, we are going to have a major event in this area. On August the 12th, there's going to be a special school board election to fill a vacancy. One of its most prominent school board members died suddenly a few months ago and necessitated the issue of what to do about either appointing someone to that position or having an election, a citywide, well, actually, a district-wide election to fill that position. I'm going to get into the details of that particular area in a few minutes. But for right now, I want to go back and talk about some of the things that we've talked about in the past, and that is public schools. Remember, public schools have most of the time been a non-kind of event. We organized our public schools back in the late 1800s, and they became public because communities started funding them through their taxes, and we went on our merry way. Schools became the go-to institution for solving social problems. Whenever there's a problem, we would turn to the school and ask them to create a course, a curriculum dealing with the problem. Then we got into a period where different interest groups wanted to control public education for their own purposes, and we've had these battles back and forth for 100 years plus. Well, in all of this, public schools and their school boards did get some attention, but not nearly as much as issues with teachers, curriculum, defining the purpose of education, how we should educate our students, etc. Well, as I also mentioned in the past, crises, real or manufactured, have played a critical role in our public education. And in the area of school board and school board elections, let me go back. When I say school boards and school board elections, I'm talking about a system whereby local people are asked to select and then elect representatives from the community to serve on a school board. It's a democratic, in theory, it's a democratic process, And it's a process that has been in play for 100 years or so. What I'm going to get to in a moment is how that process has started to change. But back to my history lesson, and that is crises. How certain crises has impacted public education and also school boards. And one of the first crises that I want to mention happened in 1954. That's when the U.S. Supreme Court handed down its decision in Brown versus School Board that declared segregation as unconstitutional. School boards were put in a crisis mode in that, of course, you know, in areas of different areas of our country, the South, but probably wasn't as aware of even in the East, the West, the North. School boards had to comply with federal court decisions and how they're going to desegregate the schools. Crisis brought about this action, and it also thrusted school boards into the limelight because they were the ones who had to deal with this. Then there were other crises. We mentioned before, a nation at risk that blamed the schools and indirectly the school boards for not educating our kids at a high enough level so that they would be competitive in the world marketplace, and we need to do something about it. This also impacted the importance of school boards. We have other crises. And I know I'm laughing here because we've talked about this. No Child Left Behind placed a tremendous burden on school boards to meet the conditions established by No Child Left Behind. We now are operating under Race to the Top, Obama's Race to the Top. School boards have to, again, deal with the pressures of meeting the requirements of federal mandates. But these are things that happen nationally. Today, we're going to talk about what's happening here in my city, Los Angeles. Hopefully, you remember that I'm based in Los Angeles. And we have a guest who, after I introduce him, you will see that he is a very significant person in this district of school board and dealing with the various issues that school boards have to deal with. And I'm referring to Mr. Robert Skills, who is a social justice writer, public education advocate. He also is an advocate for immigration rights. He lives here, and he works here, and he writes and organizes here in Los Angeles with his wife. Robert is a U.S. Navy veteran and a very proud member of Veterans for Peace. He attended school here in Los Angeles. He graduated from Glendale Community College. Just recently, when I say recently, just a few months ago, graduated from the University of California at Los Angeles, UCLA, with a bachelor's in classical civilization. And he is currently a first-year law student at People's College of Law. Robert is a prolific writer. He has articles that have appeared and essays that have appeared in publications including School Matter, Counterpunch, Dissent Voice, Daily Censored, Echo Park Patch, K-12NN, Los Angeles Progressive, and the Los Angeles Daily News. And this is the big point for me here, and 2013, Robert ran for the Los Angeles Unified School District School Board against a billionaire-funded corporate reform candidate. He finished second in a field of five. He garnered over 5,000 votes, which was a pretty awesome feat. And with that, we're going to welcome Robert Hill. Robert, welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Miller.
Robert, I want to go back in history a little bit before we get into what's happening today. Do you remember Bobby Fiedler?
Actually, I don't.
Okay. Bobby Fiedler, and the reason I mention this, as I mentioned earlier, when the Supreme Court decision, 1954, came down, school districts all across the country had to desegregate. Well, it took some time, as you, if hopefully some of you will remember, the Supreme Court said with all deliberate speed. They didn't set a time limit on when you had to do it. And so time would go by here in Los Angeles from 1954 to about 1977, when the school board ordered busing. Thousands of parents were opposed to school busing for desegregation purposes. Los Angeles is a huge, huge city geographically. We're almost big enough to be several cities in one. But in one area of the city called the San Fernando Valley, that's where during the 70s you found your middle-class white communities, people who, some of them who had left the cities to move out to the suburbs. Well, Bobby Fiedler was a mother who was opposed to school busing. She got involved, became an activist, and a movement started in the San Fernando Valley where over 30,000 other mothers organized to fight school busing, putting pressure on the school board to withdraw its plan of busing their kids from the valley or kids into the valley. Well, Bobby Fiedler gained fame from her protest, so much so that she ran for school board. The Los Angeles is divided into several different districts. She ran for the district, one of the districts out of the San Fernando Valley. She won overwhelmingly and began her crusade to thwart school integration. She was so successful at it that she also parlayed that school board position into a run for Congress. She won that, served in Congress, and then she ran for the U.S. Senate, and she lost. The reason I bring Bobby Fiedler up is that here in Los Angeles, you know, the West was considered a liberal region of the country. Los Angeles was kind of liberal. The state was kind of liberal. And Bobby Fiedler at the time was a Democrat. And she started one of the most successful anti-busing campaigns ever. And it shows you how important school boards can become in moments of crisis, social issues, social problems, and social movement. Again, why do I bring this up? Because what's happening today here in Los Angeles is not quite a repeat of 1977, but the race itself has the same powerful potential impact on what happens here in Los Angeles and what could happen across the country. So, that's my little history, a little background here on school boards in Los Angeles. Robert, you ran for school board. You ran for school board not quite a year ago. Tell us about, one, why you decide to run for school board, and then, two, the race itself.
We had just got done fighting to save the adult education program in Los Angeles Unified School District. Superintendent Daisy, who's a graduate of the Broad Superintendent's Academy, is also a former executive of the Gates Foundation, has a long record of shutting down adult education programs. He did so in Santa Monica, and he did in another district that he was in. And so we fought very vigorously to save that program. It's the lifeblood, particularly of low-income and immigrant families, for the parents to go and get educated or take ESL classes or learn trades. It's really, really important. And you can't really you can't even differentiate between that and K-12 because most of the families that the K-12 kids are really impacted had parents in the adult ed program, and it also does the the credit recovery for high school students. So it was a for them to threaten to close the program entirely was a major issue. So really, after we ended up saving the program, although albeit at about 2/3 the size that it was prior to Daisy's attempt to cut it, I was asked by a lot of people in my community to run for school board because it was clear that Ms. Garcia, Monica Garcia, who represents District 2, my district, has always put corporate interests ahead of that of the community, including her, she was one of the cheerleaders of shutting down the adult education program, which is something that was really surprising given, the demographic that she says she serves. And so I was asked to run by my community, and I did.
And so tell me about the race itself.
We had a real large base of volunteers, a lot of students that were adult education students, a lot of families that really believed in the the platform that I was progressing. It's funny because all of us that fight against corporate education reform are always accused of being supporters of the status quo. And for years, I've fought for ethnic studies in schools, critical pedagogy based on the teachings of Paulo Freire, desegregation, which is funny because your lead into this was about a woman that literally went for resegregation, and a lot of these very, very progressive ideas. So we were running on a platform that attracted a lot of families and a lot of progressives, a lot of individual teachers. I did get endorsed by the teachers union, but they did a strategy of endorsing several people. So I was just one of three people that UCLA had endorsed, and they actually spent more money on the other candidates than me. But I was able to garner endorsements from major national figures, including Dr. Diane Rabbit, who's a professor of history at New York University, and everybody knows her credentials. She's probably considered one of the foremost experts in education history in the country. Dr. James Horn, Dr. Stephen Krashen, who's somebody that I read all of his work. The Administrators Association, ALA, endorsed me. I had the endorsements of various civil rights groups, including Union de Barrio, Association of Raza Educators. So we had this really huge grassroots, no real big money support. We raised $20,000, and the biggest contribution we had was a $500 contribution from the Administrators Union. Everything else was like $10, $20 contributions from parents, teachers, individuals, and this huge volunteer base. So we worked really, really hard, and I think we put a great deal of pressure on Ms. Garcia, who was getting these huge contributions from Rupert Murdoch of Fox News. Mike Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, put in $1 million into the pool against the people that were running against Monica and her little enclave. All of these different huge businesses, right-wing donors. And so she had at the end of the day, she had essentially $2 million, and we had $20,000. So to do as well as we did, we got over 15% of the electorate. It was quite, a testament to the volunteers and to all the people that worked really, really hard on the campaign, because, I think that we had a message that resonated, and we changed the tenor of the debate. When it's usually the framework of the debate, the limits of the debate are like, who's going to do the corporate reforms with more vigor? And I was able to come in and say, we don't want Common Core. We want ethnic studies. We don't want to, we want to diminish standardized testing, and we want to bring arts and other curricula back into our classrooms, and we want to reduce class size. And I was saying things that are never even allowed in the debate before, and it really, really shifted all of, we had these major public debates and stuff, and it really put Ms. Garcia on the defensive because she's just used to kind of regurgitating the corporate education buzzwords and all that talk that they have, and she was forced to have to defend her record and herself and her, basically her allegiance to the lucrative charter industry. So it was a really exciting campaign. It was exhausting, but we worked really, really hard. And I think that it allowed us to really kind of shift what people talk about in these school board races.
You bring up a very important point that I wanted you to bring up. and that is the corporate side, the corporate, what I call the corporate state elite, and their Machiavellian agenda to destroy public education. And what that refers to is the fact that the corporate entities want to control public education because they want to destroy it. I'm saying it slowly because my audience have heard me say this over and over and over again. What you have brought up, and the reason that I'm doing the show today, is that teachers and teachers' unions have been the targets of this war waged by the corporate side. School boards were kind of like an afterthought. But then there was a shift in looking at school boards. But that shift also occurred after another event took place on a major local stage that had national ramifications, and that is state legislatures giving control of local school districts to mayors. I think, and I may be wrong on this point, but I think Chicago was the first, Mayor Daley in Chicago, then Mayor Bloomberg, Michael Bloomberg in New York, and then there were mayors who got control of school districts in the Midwest and other parts of the country. Out here in Los Angeles, the first attempt that I know about occurred during a mayor that was Robert Reardon. Do you remember Robert Reardon?
Richard Reardon?
Richard Reardon.
Okay, yes, absolutely.
Okay. He sought to get control of the school district and have himself appointed mayor and control of public education. That didn't work. Failed. Voters said no to it. He had a plan B, and that plan B was to run a slate for the school board. And if his slate won, they would take control in terms of majority vote. Hence, he could control via his school board. That happened. He was successful in getting his school board elected. Then the next mayor, Mayor Villaraigosa, he also decided that he wanted to be like Michael Bloomberg in New York, like Mayor Daley in Chicago. He wanted control of the Los Angeles school district. He also tried and failed. But you just mentioned several of his minions were put on the school board, and the lady that you ran against was one of his minions. Am I correct?
That's absolutely true.
So we see here that the school board, at least here in Los Angeles, has evolved to the point where every mayor for the last, 16 years, have sought to gain control of the school board. That was their plan A. Their plan B was to load the school board up with their people, hence giving them indirect control. And we have a new mayor who's been in office less than a year. And would you believe there is possibly a third attempt to find a way to turn the school board over to, well, the school district over to the mayor, taking it out of the hands of locally elected school board members? Are you aware of this?
In terms of, because I'm not sure, Garcetti seems to be a little less aggressive about getting involved in, school board election. So I was curious to know what exactly you're referring to.
There's a commission report that came out, 2 months ago,
Oh, wow.
That suggested very strongly that Los Angeles should go the way of New York, Chicago, and other places and have mayor control. The man wasn't in office properly 4 months before this commission came up with its report, and one of its major recommendations was turning over elected school board to...
I mean, that's not unsurprising, given that it's a core tenet of the Broad Foundation's, you know, method for you know, running school districts across the country. Garcetti, while maybe not as tightly tied to those forces, certainly ingratiates himself and doesn't, you know, I've never heard him speak badly of the Broad Foundation, so I think that maybe he's not as publicly, you know, out in the open about his ties with them, but he certainly has them. And it wouldn't surprise me that there's a commission report saying that. I can't imagine, you know, corporate education reform saying anything other than, you know, mayoral control would be the way forward, because that's the easiest way to subvert any kind of democratic process. It's the easiest way to remove agency from communities. So you've seen, you know, the cities that have it, you know, you have a Rahm Emanuel in Chicago, you have, you know, Mike Bloomberg was in New York until very recently, you know, they're able to run their school districts like dictators without any kind of, you know, anytime parents or communities protested, these hand-appointed boards that these mayors appointed would just kind of sit and, you know, ignore any kind of pleas from the community and just rubber stamp the mayor's policies. And they would love to have that here in the second largest school district in the country as well.
Well, to what extent, if any, did your run for school board, and was it Monica, what's her last name?
Garcia or Ratliff?
I can't remember. Not Garcia.
Monica Ratliff from District 6 in the Valley?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, okay. What impact did your running and Monica's running as basically two small Davids up against huge corporate Goliath? How did the outcome of that election affect the school board itself in terms of the kinds of policies for the results of the election in 2013?
Sure. Well, it's interesting because I think they were so fearful of me winning. That they put a lot of resources into defeating me. And it kind of allowed Monica Ratliff to kind of sneak under the radar, so to speak. And so they woke up the day after Election Day and realized that there was going to be a runoff in District 6. And I think they underestimated the kind of degree of like cronyism and just kind of like that old, I mean, you know, we used to see it with old Chicago politics, right? Well, all the nepotism and all that. Where Villaraigosa had handpicked a kid named Antonio Sanchez, who had no experience in education, was completely out of his element, running against a veteran teacher who really, really had made her credentials working at a very, very low-income school in downtown L.A. and doing wonderful work. And, you know, I think it allowed her to really, you know, it allowed us to frame it as, you know, here's a professional educator running against a neophyte that has no background in education. And they'd already expended so many resources to beat me, it allowed her to get elected. Ms. Ratliff has done some good work. We're real happy with what she's done. She's not, you know, she's not a left activist, so she's not going to be championing things like the fight against Common Core or, you know, to demand less standardized testing, but she's been good on fighting against the iPad expenditures and some other things. So I think we did have a major impact just in terms of changing the debate and getting her elected, because it would have been more of this, like you were saying earlier, you know, since Richard Reardon, we've basically had school boards that have been stacked with corporate reformers and charter school sycophants. And so, you know, anything that the corporate reform junta wanted, they had a school board majority every single time. It was just a foregone conclusion. Anything they wanted, it was rubber stamped because their people were in there. It changed the dynamic of the school board, because now, even though it's not weighted one way or the other, they don't have the immediate six votes or five votes that they had in the past. And so they've actually got to work when they want it, and they have to, like, pull one of the other people over. So it's been more difficult for them to railroad through their normal agenda. They're still getting a lot of what they want. I mean, Daisy has, you know, forces, his connections with the nonprofit industrial complex, large organizations like the United Way, Greater Los Angeles, allows him to stage, you know, these very, these basically AstroTurf protests, and it allows them to put political pressure on the good school board members. So they're still getting what they want quite frequently, but it's just not with the, you know, to the degree that they were able to earlier. So I think it made a significant impact, both in terms of changing the terms of the debate on the 2013 elections, and also getting Ms. Ratliff elected, which really kind of, I really don't believe that they ever, you know, they spent so much money against all of us. You know, it was Zimmer, myself, and Ratliff were the ones running in the even districts. And, you know, the Zimmer race, of course, was really hotly contested. The UCLA spent $1 million, and the corporate reformers spent some $3 million. But our races were kind of like not really, you know, there wasn't a lot of money being spent by the pro-public education side. And nevertheless, we were able to, you know, scare them in my district and then get the win with Ms. Ratliff in District 6. So I think it was a significant impact all around.
Yes, it was. Again, I'm here in Los Angeles, and I know about all of this. But let me put it in a bigger picture. There was a time, and not so long ago, when running for school board was the least exciting, least important thing anyone could do. In many locales, if you were elected, it was a part-time position. You met infrequently. You really didn't have that much to do or to say. It was business as usual. People would run for school board seats spending a few $100s, maybe a few $1,000s. And when you got up to $15,000, $20,000 for a local school board election, that was big, big time. Now, as you just mentioned, Robert, millions of dollars are poured into school board elections. Millions. And depending on if it's a big urban locale like a New York, like a Chicago, like a Los Angeles, you're talking about outside money coming in by the truckloads, pitting the corporate reformer against the local representative, and a truly David versus Goliath, almost no contest situation. And your race, and it's one of the things that I wanted you to talk about, and you did for me, highlighted the importance of what's going on now in the second largest school district in the nation. You have corporate interests, outside interests, pouring money into the election process, selecting almost their own candidate, and pretty much driving the election towards their candidates being elected. The notion of local school board election is almost a misnomer now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in many cases, it's national, and also some cases, international election. And by the latter statement, I mean, you have now under Citizen United and other Supreme Court decisions where foreign companies, individuals, can pour money into American elections. There's an organization called Pearson.
Pearson, yeah.
You know who I'm talking about. They are the largest. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say Pearson PLC is the largest publisher and test company in the world. They've purchased up all the large textbook companies that like Macmillan and stuff like that in the United States. All of Common Core is through Pearson. They just recently bought up the GED. So all of the testing and preparatory materials for that are going to, they're also going to be working with David Coleman to do the SAT. So, you know, the amount of money, I mean, just the amount of profit alone that's on the line. So they do have a very vested interest in these school board elections and these kind of things. So you're right on the money saying that it's actually an international. It's gone beyond a national scale. It's international.
Yes. And what I really want you to highlight for us now, since you've gone through this, is the current situation here. We have, well, let's take it from the beginning. On the school board that you were running for a position on in 2013, there was a very prominent teacher turned school board member who died, as I said earlier, suddenly, and creating the current situation. Take us through the event.
Margaret Poindexter Lamont was a dear friend of mine. And, I just want to say before we go any further that, we always want to honor her memory because she was just a wonderful person that dedicated her life to educating the children of Los Angeles. And it's interesting because her story is very, very similar to the person that, in the current narrative, of course. She's someone that's originally from Louisiana, born in the South, lived through segregation, became educated, became a teacher, was a longtime principal at several schools here in Los Angeles, and was a stalwart, anti-corporate reformer on our board, was in her third term, and she actually died when she was at a conference for school boards in San Diego. So, I mean, even in her passing, she was doing something in service to the children of Los Angeles, and she was just an amazing individual. And did you want to go into the narrative leading into the special election, or did you want to discuss something else before that?
A little both. Her death, how it was handled in terms of the impact on school board, in the sense that there was a debate, long-term debate, on whether or not to just appoint someone to fill her position, since her position is going to be up for full-term re-election in 2015 or 16?
Yes, next year, actually. So.
Okay, and whether or not the school district should spend money to do a special election. And take us through all of that, and then we'll get to where we are today, this moment.
Most people, especially because there were some really critical votes, going to be presented to the board over the last 9 months, that most people were in agreement that an appointing an interim board member was the way to go forward. And the corporate reformers saw this as an opportunity not only to cost the school district money, because, you said earlier, and sometimes people think it's hyperbole, you said earlier that the end goal of the corporate reformers is to essentially destroy public education, and that's absolutely true. And there's one of the writers for the other side, his name is Andy Smarek, and he's written, he's a member of the American Enterprise Institute, and he writes for the right-wing Hoover Institution. He wrote an article for they have a journal called Education Next, and he wrote an article talking about how to bankrupt urban school districts. And this is kind of, part and parcel, people say, well, this is conspiracy theory. When the other side writes about it in a public journal, that's not a conspiracy, that's policy. And so, this is what we have, is these kind of things are intentional. They wanted to force a special election to cost the district a great deal of money. They wanted to ensure that Daisy didn't have dissenting votes against his iPad and some of the other things he's been trying to push through. And they also saw it as an opportunity, knowing that UTLA and any of the forces that oppose corporate education reform don't really have a lot of money. So forcing back-to-back elections, a special election, and then essentially 14, 16 months later, a regular election for the same seat, they have unlimited resources. Rupert Murdoch and Eli Broad and Philip Anschutz and all these people that usually give to the other side, they never run out of money, right? So they can do several elections in a row giving millions of dollars. It's no big deal to them. But for communities or for teachers, that's too much money. So this is kind of deliberate. They pushed for the special election. The community pushed for the appointment. And they put enough political pressure on the board that they decided to do the special election despite it being bad for the district. So not only has District 1 been essentially unrepresented this entire time, but they've spent all this money to elect a person that, you know, that they've handpicked who has no background whatsoever in education and who's really his only qualifications is that he would be a rubber stamp for the California Charter Schools Association. So it's been a very depressing situation here in Los Angeles, running against a lifelong educator and Dr. George McKenna, whose record speaks for itself. Just like Marguerite Lamont, comes from Louisiana, lived through segregation, became a math teacher, became a principal, became a local superintendent, and also became a superintendent of a school district just south of here. Spent his entire life in service of the children of the Los Angeles area. Is such a famous character that they actually made a movie about him starring Denzel Washington. This man is eminently qualified for the seat, but because there's a fear that he doesn't like John Daisy, this is why the corporate reformers are spending this just unbelievable amounts of money. I mean, when I go through the 460 forms and just see the amounts that are being donated, it's somewhat staggering to see the amounts of money being spent to elect this Alex Johnson character.
Let me interject. When the decision was made to do an interim election, how many candidates appeared? Something
we
like
had,
eight or so?
Was yeah, eight? There was about eight, yeah.
And of the eight candidates, and this is important, District 1 is a minority district. Heavily black and Hispanic. District 1, from the very beginning when we cut the Los Angeles School Board up into districts and then started voting per district for school board seat as opposed to an at-large election, District 1 was represented by Marguerite, a black African-American woman, and she held that position up until her death.
Mm-hmm.
Then when the decision, as I said, was made to do this interim election, we had people coming out of, I will say, the woodwork to go for this position. All of the people were African-American, all Democrats, as far as I know. Maybe one possibly could be a Republican, the woman who was on the TV show with the famous Republican guy, I can't remember his name right now.
Donald Trump.
With Donald Trump. I don't know. But anyway, and the reason I bring this up is that here you're talking about a overwhelmingly, predominantly African-American district and Hispanic district.
I was going to say, demographically, District 1 is actually more Hispanic than it is African-American. And a lot of people don't know that, but that's the actual...
I caught myself.
Yeah.
I mean, you just exposed me, but that's okay.
No.
I'm joking. Don't even go there. I'm joking.
Yeah.
But anyway, the point I want to make was that here we have all these candidates are African-American, male and female, largely Democrat, and we have one person, a Democrat, who is the handpicked person for the corporate side. As you mentioned, no experience. And did you know, and I'm not sure what I'm about to say is correct because I've only been able to get this from one source, that Alex Johnson was in New York City for a while, and I think the source says worked for the Department of Education there.
Mm-hmm.
His role was part of the squad that put teachers in the rubber room, which out here is called teacher jail, and that was never mentioned. in terms of part of his experience in education for coming back. Now, again, I've only found one source for that.
No, I've got several sources on that myself. He was answerable to Michael Bloomberg. And not only did he put them in, their rubber room or what he would have, his job was prosecuting to get them separated from the district. And he literally spent his entire time with the New York Department of Education prosecuting teachers of color to get them fired, which is really, really shameful when you think about it at the end of the day. So.
Yeah, but that's a point that has not been brought up as far as I can see in the media here, either the blogosphere or L.A. Times.
That'll never appear in the L.A. Times.
Yeah, I just found it a few days ago.
There is an article in the L.A. Times from a long time ago that does mention that he worked as a prosecutor for the New York Department of Education. That's one of the sources I have on it. But they didn't mean it. They weren't trying to contextualize it. So, when you put it in that context, then all of a sudden it takes on a whole different meaning, what his role was for Bloomberg. So,
yes, and I'm leading to now you and I talking about the head-to-head contest between McKenna and Johnson. I will say this before we begin. I would vote for McKenna, hands down, not a single thought of voting for Johnson. That's a partisan statement, putting it out there. You have a partisan statement that I want you to make as well.
Well, I mean, in the fairness of full disclosure, I worked on one of the other candidates' campaigns. Before the primary election, but now that it is in the runoff election, I am fully behind Dr. McKenna. A lot of the people that I've done organizing with for years from District 1, including several of Marguerite Stafford's, of course, are all huge fans of Dr. McKenna. Have worked with him over the decades. His record speaks for itself. So I'm very much so in the McKenna camp, in the fairness of and interest of full disclosure. So,
right, and as you and I had talked, that I felt it's very important that we both make our full disclosure statement. Now let's go tear up Alex. Now let's go and an article that you wrote recently, and it was entitled "The Case Against Alex Johnson." Let's go into that.
Sure. Any specifics that you wanted to discuss from the article?
No, all the points that you want to make. Your article, you...
I mean, that information is a little dated because it was for the primary. I've been working on a second article. Actually, the day before yesterday, I was going through the 460 forms for the current fundraising and found some really interesting finds, because what the case against Alex Johnson was based on several factors. One, who's funding him, right? Because as soon as if you really want to know what a candidate's going to represent and who a candidate's going to represent, who's funding them? So if it's community members and individual teachers, they're going to actually represent the community that they live in. If it's large multinational corporations, if it's ideologically charged billionaires, then who they're going to represent. And Johnson's, just the money he raised from the California Charter Schools Association alone was more than all the smaller candidates that ran in the primary election. Just that expenditure, just the CCSA's expenditure alone, was more than all of the small teacher-based candidates, basically, that ran. I mean, that shows a lot about what this election is, really who he is going to serve, what his agenda is going to be, what kind of curriculums he's going to be pushing for. And so I think that was really the article was about who's funding him, his lack of background, really some of the civil rights leaders that I quoted that have written articles that have been really, really, excoriating towards Johnson in terms of his relationship with Mark Ridley. I'm a little tired. Is it Mark Ridley Jones? The gentleman that's the county supervisor that he's basically coming out of his camp, and all of these connections to big money, special interests, and none of this has to do with serving the children of District 1.
It comes down to, at least my summation would be, local representation versus corporate national interest. We have two candidates that are prototypes of those two different competing communities. And what the public should be aware of, and this goes for all elections, we should all do our due diligence in terms of coming to know the candidate. And as you just said, when you take it a little further, who's financing them? Because those people who are financing them, they're not doing it out of the goodness of their heart. They want a return on their investment.
Mm-hmm.
And that return means, and here in Los Angeles, oh well, even, let's go nationally. I've said this many, many times in the past. Nationally, education expenditures, $1.2 to some estimates, $1.5 trillion a year.
Mm-hmm.
Globally, estimates are $7 trillion a year. There obviously is a lot of money to be made from the education community, and if you have vested interest, like a Rupert Murdoch, Pearson, you then want to have your people in place, not just in the local school or on the local school board. You want that, if possible, you want the superintendent in that office. You want the state superintendent in that office.
They're working on that too right now. So
I know they are. That's why I'm bringing it up. You want as many of your people in state legislature. If you have a bicameral legislature, like we do here, the Senate and Assembly here, you want, even if you can, the governor, and you also know that you want the President of the United States, which they have, and the Secretary of Education, which they have. You want all the pieces as you can get your hands on in order to ensure that you're going to get a large piece of that $1.2 to $1.5 trillion budget, or if you globally, as I said, $7 trillion budget. And I see the race that we're talking about as having come down to what the scenario was from the very beginning. To get Alex Johnson, if not appointed, then elected, and then to set him up to go in 2015 for a full-term election. Putting another one of the corporate minions on the board so that, as you mentioned, decisions that will be made will always be made in favor of the corporate interest. And specifically, and I want to go back a little bit, here in Los Angeles, maybe some of you already know about this, school board, at the recommendation of our superintendent, the current superintendent, agreed to spend $1 point something billion for some damn iPad and the curriculum of the largest publishing company in the on the globe, software for the iPad. They voted to take money out of a bond issue that the people here in Los Angeles voted for years ago to rehab crumbling schools, build new schools. This board, because they had the vote, Daisy had the vote, was able to get the board to say yes to spending this $1.something estimated by the way, we don't even know what the final tab is going to be. $1 billion. And I think, and you correct me on this, Robert, wasn't it a non-bid situation?
Yeah, it was a no-bid situation. And a lot of people are getting caught up on the hardware, you know, on the iPad thing. And you know, you mentioned the real moneymaker, the real insidious part is the Pearson software for Common Core. This isn't even like, you know, standard iPads that kids could use to learn how to program or something like that. The purpose of these iPads is they're locked in specifically for the Common Core state standard curriculum, which is something that was put up by non-educators, by the corporate reform forces to enforce a very narrow, to steal the words of bell hooks, a white supremacist, patriarchal, capitalist agenda, and so Pearson, of course, controls Common Core. It's a very, very tightly controlled curriculum, and Daisy was able to railroad this through, like you said, because he has the votes on the board. We've got schools that are still not earthquake retrofitted, so like the next major earthquake, they could fall down, and that's what that bond money was supposed to be used for, was to retrofit these schools and to fix leaking roofs and, major health and safety issues. And instead, the money's being squandered, on technology for something that people don't want. I mean, nationwide, people don't want Common Core curriculum. What we really want are curriculums that are responsive to, that are culturally responsive and responsive to the communities that people live in. And instead, we're getting this corporate curriculum that was essentially funded by the Gates Foundation and forced it on us by a non-educator named David Coleman. So it's funny because Alex Johnson will become another one of these voices pushing for more technology sales while, our kids are going to schools that have plumbing, that have heavy metals in them, that have roofs that are leaking, that have, structures that are not sound. But at least they'll have iPads to cover their heads when the roof comes falling down.
That's kind of cold, but I go for it. Let me wrap this up, because people, we have a second segment today, and it's going to start in a few minutes with Doug Martin, who was our guest the last show. But I would like to sort of like sum it up, finish it up, and Robert, give you a little time to sum it up too. I want to just say that reiterating the importance of school board and the importance of who we elect to be our representatives on school board. It's a position that, as I said earlier, up until recently was about as important as electing a dog catcher. Yeah, they used to have dog catcher elections that we don't have those anymore. But that's how important it was. That has changed. The advent of this war that I paid at the start of a nation at risk, picked up big time with No Child Left Behind, put on steroids with Race to the Top, have changed the entire environment of the importance of the local school board and the importance of keeping school boards democratically, locally elected members, as opposed to being individuals who are Trojan horses for national, international interests. Our local school board should represent the values, the beliefs, the goals of the local community. Our school board should be there to try every single day to see to it that our schools have what they need from the teachers and the principals and other staff, what they need to help every child get a quality, high standard education. Not taking tests and et cetera, but to learn, to develop, and to become
good people, I'll say that. And the school board should not be a conduit for outside interests, be it state, local, or national, international, to get what they want in terms of their hands on the money that flow through our school board. School board officials have to be their policymakers, their administrators, their representatives of the community's interest in educating our children. And one last thing here. Even people who don't have children in school and they blow off the election, I want to say something about that, and that all children in school today are going to be part of the workforce that is going to provide services, either on the public goods, public services, or private services, that are going to be the ones who are going to move the country forward. And we need to take an interest in our school board, even though we don't have kids in school, because these are the kids of the future. And if those of us today live long enough, these kids will be the ones that will be providing the services that I mentioned for us in the future, and our grandkids, and et cetera. School boards are very important. Don't take them for granted. Understand what's going on. Understand the big picture. And be an informed voter when you go in there to vote for your school board. Robert, I'll let you close, too.
Okay. Two regards that you know how important democratically elected school boards are for two reasons. And it's because the corporate class and the ruling class try to get rid of them two different ways. One is mayoral control. We discussed that earlier in the segment. The other way is through their corporate charter schools, right? Charter schools are private institutions that receive public money to ostensibly provide the same services that public schools provide. They don't, of course, because they selectively choose who they educate and who they don't. But none of them have elected boards either. They're always, because at least in California, they're 501c3s. And so they have boards that basically self-select, and they tend to be the same corporate people and local, usually wealthy people in the community, like wealthy lawyers or something like that. They're unelected. And so when you have a situation like a company that one of the board members has a friend that owns a software company that wants to sell a product or service, there's no bid. They just go in, they convince the board, and they get the sale. And this is what corporate America wants. Is they want the ability, like you were saying earlier, to use all of that money. It's a guaranteed revenue stream for their own interests. And the other thing, because it's not just about profits, of course, is who determines what's being taught. And I think that, we see with Common Core this real propensity of the ownership class to push through their agenda, their ideals, their ideologies. And, in our communities, there is a ray of hope. A very, very close friend of mine, he's actually an LA Unified School school teacher, recently got elected to the El Rancho Unified School District, which is the Pico Rivera area, which is just south of Los Angeles. And one of his first acts as a school board member was to require ethnic studies as a requirement for graduating seniors in the ERUSD school district. So, you know, on the one hand, we can see what having corporately elected school boards do in Los Angeles, where you have people voting to give these huge contracts, these no bid contracts to Pearson, right? But on the other hand, we see when we actually get real community local representatives elected to school boards, that we have dynamic, progressive things like ethnic studies being part of the core curriculum in our school. So, you know, I'm going to continue to fight for the latter. And I hope that, you know, your listeners do the same.
Okay, Robert, thank you very much. We've gone over our time. We were going to have a second segment with Doug Martin, as I mentioned earlier, who was with us last week, but there are technical difficulties, and we're not able to bring him on. So we're going to just end with today's segment with just what we've done so far. And I'll be back in 2 weeks. But I will say this, coming back, working on putting together what I consider to be a very, very special show, and it has to do with, and I'm going to give you the title as what the show is, I think is going to be called. And it's going to be called The State and the Fate of Teachers Union in the Wake of War. As I've said many, many times, teachers and their union, public education in general, are being attacked. The purpose of destroying public education and the targets for accomplishing victory is to get rid of the teachers, get rid of the unions, and as I mentioned today, get rid of the elected school board members. There are problems in our teachers' union that emanate from inside the union, and as I just mentioned, there are forces on the outside that are trying to destroy the union, and we're going to take an in-depth look at the issues surrounding the survival of the union and whether or not they can survive. I'm working to get a international stellar group of guests. I won't mention that who they are, although one has been confirmed. And it will be, hopefully, a two-hour special. And it's going to be a doozy, as the old folks used to say. So with that, I say good afternoon to everyone. And pro football is back, and I'm off to go watch my first preseason game. Have a good evening, everyone. Robert.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.